What happened to stable government? What happened to the promise that if you voted for the Liberal and National parties, you'd have proper stable government with a Prime Minister for a term and proper cabinet processes?
In 2016, Malcolm Turnbull stood in front of a sign that bore the phrase stable government.
Only a Liberal or National vote ensures stable government.
As the final weeks of federal parliament for 2018 draw to a close, that phrase has become somewhat of a punchline. This week, Turnbull himself has gone into full wrecking mode, bringing his attacks on Scott Morrison out into the open.
And as Scott Morrison knows, I've given him every support and plenty of good and useful advice, for which he's acknowledged.
The Liberal Party threw democracy under the bus to save the pre-selection of an MP who didn't vote for either Morrison or Turnbull in August's leadership spill, Craig Kelly. And it didn't help that at the G20 in Buenos Aires, Morrison had to explain who he was to some of his counterparts.
They have their inquiries, and when you describe the parliamentary system, I mean, it's a foreign system to, you know, presidential systems, and it's readily understood.
The Prime Minister has all but announced a May 2019 election and has shifted his message onto the economy, hoping the delivery of a budget surplus will assure voters of the coalition's credentials. And in a last-minute party room meeting on Monday night, Morrison got the Liberals to agree to new rules, making it harder to dump a sitting Prime Minister.
This is the biggest change to how our party deals with these matters since Robert Menzies first established the party 74 years ago.
Events of the past, back in 2015 and repeated a few months ago, will not be repeated into the future.
He would have been hoping for clear air, but the forecast is for persistent political fog. From the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, this is Please Explain, a weekly podcast where you and I get the full story on some of the most significant issues facing Australia and a look inside the newsrooms that bring them to you. I'm Tory Maguire. To mark the end of the last sitting week for the year, I've asked Please Explain's political heavyweights to join us. Peter Harcher is the international and politics editor of the Sydney Morning Herald. David Crowe is the chief political correspondent of The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. And Chris Yuleman is the political editor of the Nine Network. From Monday, Chris will also be our colleague after the merger of Fairfax and Nine becomes official. Peter, Chris, David, thanks so much for being here on the last sitting day of the last sitting week of the year. David, I want to start with you. What state is the government in?
In a pretty volatile state today, I think, Tory, because last sitting day of the year, you can always expect some kind of tricky tactics from Labor to put the government on the back foot, and that's what we'll see today, or that's the way things are going, because there will be this attempt to challenge the government on the numbers on the floor of the House on asylum seeker policy. Now, it's going to be a very fluid day of tactical manoeuvres on all sides, and I think the government may have a plan to slow everything down so that they get to the finish line on Thursday night without having to face a critical vote. It'll be down to their tacticians.
And if it succeeds and they do lose this vote, what are the consequences of that?
It's a huge embarrassment because governments do not lose votes on substantial legislation. It's bad enough to lose a vote on a procedural matter where it's a process matter on the floor. But here it would be the passage of an actual bill with amendments passed against the will of the government on the floor of both the Senate and the House. The question is whether that would then come into force because it would have to be proclaimed by the Governor General and put through by the Executive Council. So that's a lot of the technicalities. The reality is it would be an embarrassment, a humiliation, because it would confirm the government's loss of control of the numbers on the floor of the lower house.
Yeah, and an example of that, I think, that we'd have to double check this, but it was 1929, I think, the last time that this happened, Stanley Melbourne Bruce's government, and the next day he called an election.
Right. And Peter, how nervous are the government about this? I mean, is this feeding into a sense of panic?
Well, yes. I mean, look, the question the government should be asking itself in a normal situation is how far do we have to go to recover to put ourselves in an election-winning territory? Instead, they find themselves asking the question, have we yet hit rock bottom? And the answer is, look at exactly this phenomenon in the House. They're a minority government that last week got more minor than it was the week before. They don't control the floor and they're now terrified of exactly the sort of humiliation that David spoke of. So, of course, they're deeply troubled. Of course, they're panicked. And remember, even when they were a majority on the lower house of the parliament, with Christopher Pyne as manager of government business, they still managed on three different occasions to lose votes simply through bungling and mismanagement. So it's not a prospect that would fill any prime minister's heart with gladness.
So they're limping over the finish line to the end of this sitting period.
Yeah, and maybe we should look at the substance of the issue that's causing this, because it's barely 10 days or 2 weeks since Julia Banks quit the Liberal Party to go to the crossbench, and that's been the significant shift in the numbers here. And she's done that in the wake of a Victorian state election where the Liberals copped an absolute walloping. And she would be voting for stronger rules to get medical transfers of asylum seekers off Nauru and Manus Island. And it shows that she has decided that this is an issue where, to be more in touch with the Australian people, she sides against the government on this issue. I think that reflects perhaps a shift in perception about what the Australian community wants on this issue, as well as just being a tactical play on the floor of the chamber.
And Tori, it's interesting that this is part of a larger pattern where the government is not only losing control of the agenda, but the whole tide of history is flowing past a government that is really stuck. So while the government is still tied in knots over the same things it's been tied in knots over for years, which are energy and climate policy on the one hand, and the religious freedom question, which is really a byproduct of the same-sex marriage debate that they had over the last couple of years. They're still stuck trying to deal with those, let's call them legacy issues, to use a euphemism. In the meantime, the independents, as David says, are not only working on a bill to get people off Nauru, but also getting a federal ICAC, a federal anti-corruption or National Integrity Commission, against the will of the government, again, working with Labor and the crossbench, try and overcome government resistance. And taking a step back and looking at a slightly larger picture, with the government having failed to fully solve the live export question, the industry itself is now putting a three-month moratorium on live export of sheep and cattle out of Australia during the summer months. On energy policy, Australians are responding to the failure of problem-solving in Canberra by massively ramping up rooftop installations, not just homes, but businesses. The Business Council's members, big business, are talking among themselves about setting up their own carbon scheme, carbon permit scheme. It really is making the government look isolated and stuck in the past.
Yeah, and when you marry all of those things together, it appears, and it certainly was obvious in the Victorian election, that this is a party, this coalition of Nationals and Liberals, who no longer understands what it is anymore, and the population has no idea what it is anymore. It's in a constant quest for its mythical base, and we find in Victoria, in the Liberals, that's 30% of the electorate. It's 5% for the Nationals. They cannot form government on those kinds of numbers, and that may not be the base. We might be going further yet to find those people that are actually rusted on to this cause when this cause seems to have no purpose.
That's an interesting point, Chris, and this sort of that level, let's call it, at least for the time being, rock bottom, the base at 35% for the coalition in Victoria. That's about the same as it was in the Longman by-election in Queensland. It's about the same as the national opinion polls are giving them. 30 to 35% seems to be the range they're stuck in. So whether it's a more conservative electorate in Queensland, a more left-wing electorate in Victoria, whether it's the national opinion polls covering the entire country, the Liberals and the Coalition cannot win an election with their primary vote at 30 to 35%. That seems to be where they're stuck.
So what are they supposed to do? How are they supposed to broaden out that 35%? Because if, you know, they're stuck on that at the moment, and they're talking about very niche issues. They're talking about things that wouldn't even appeal to 35%. They would only be appealing to maybe 5 or 10% at either end.
Well, I think that's where this party, or these two parties, find themselves at the moment, is they, if you have no idea what you are, then you're hard-pressed to try and determine where it is you want to go, and you will not get anyone to follow you. And so the problem they have at the moment is they have an existential crisis. They have an identity crisis. And it couldn't be summarised better than we're seeing what was the Liberal Party talking about huge market interventions now. And it's allowing the Labor Party to say, we're having a Venezuelan-style intervention into the marketplace to try and make electricity companies that are too big divest themselves of some of the things that they own. It's almost unimaginable that you could have a Liberal Party proposing this in the past. Again, I think the only thing that will solve the crisis that they've got at the moment is a long period of time in opposition where the party may well fracture, the Liberal Party may well split in half while it tries to work out exactly what it stands for.
Well, that's, I think that's right. I mean, these are two halves of a coalition that can't live with each other. So the moderates couldn't...
And this is within the Liberal Party.
We're talking about within the Liberal Party. So yeah. The moderates couldn't tolerate a Conservative leader, namely Tony Abbott. The Conservatives couldn't tolerate a moderate leader, otherwise known as Malcolm Turnbull. So if they can't cohabit with each other, how can they possibly expect the Australian voter to want to cohabit with them as government? So it is a very deep crisis that they've got going on, but they're not about to roll over. There's 6 months to an election, and what we're going to see is Scott Morrison over the break with his party, with his cabinet, trying to come up with a, if I may use the term, fight-back technique. And some of those things we can see already. There'll be fallbacks. There'll be standard coalition strength. So one is talking about the economy, scaremongering about Labor. Another will be industrial relations, again, scaremongering about Labor. Another will be border security, again, scaremongering about Labor. And remember, a good scare campaign is a powerful thing. The Keating government, remember, was written off until he manufactured this tremendous scare campaign against John Hewson and Hewson managed to lose the unlosable election and Keating managed to win the unwinnable. So it's a two-horse race. And the lesser, the horse that's currently behind hasn't stopped running. So it would be premature to write them off completely.
So the last time that the Liberal Party was very popular and very successful, who did they represent? How would you have described the Liberal Party at a time when they were electorally successful?
Well, can I answer that by going back a little bit into history? So the Labor Party started as a sectional party representing workers, which then, to get political power, figured out that it had to become a catch-all party and broaden to the middle class, which it did. And that's been the secret of its success when it's been successful. The Liberal Party was formed in response to Labor, and Bob Menzies pulled together all the anti-Labor parties to create what is the modern coalition. So again, it was a catch-all party created to respond to Labor's catch-all party. What we now see is the retreat of the Liberal Party from catch-all status into ideological self-absorption. And unless they can work out how the two halves, the moderate half and the conservative half, can somehow bear to live in the same house with each other, then they are going to become a conservative and liberal parties, as Chris says, with the possibility of a formal split or maybe just simply an ongoing civil war, which makes them unelectable for years.
Yeah, and you can't forget in the history, and Peter points it out, is the Liberal Party is the more recent of the two. The Labor Party was there at Federation, but you had free traders and protectionists on the other side who were absolutely opposed to each other. And if you want to look at them now, that sentiment, free traders and protectionists, I think is alive and well in different forms inside the coalition at the moment.
David, do you think there's any one politician who is actually capable of bringing these sides together, or is it a structural problem within the party itself that no one human being can paper over?
I do think there's a structural problem, and you see it when the Federal Council meets, and that the Conservatives absolutely play to win, and they've done that with vice presidential positions in the voting at the organisational level. So there's no give and take there. And I think that's built into the way the party operates now. It is hard to see a future leadership option that brings them all together because the enmities are so strong now. They're not just ideological. I think it's quite revealing that in a recent opinion piece, Tony Abbott made the observation that a lot of what's happened in the last couple of years was a clash of personalities. That was an admission that it's not just an ideological difference between the different wings. The bad blood from the September 2015 coup, now deepened by the absolute poison over the August 2018 coup, means that it's very much about personalities as well as philosophies. And I think that is a very, very difficult thing to resolve. There is this idea that they would be tested by the fire of an election lost and then have to be reborn from the ashes after that defeat. But when I look at it, I think that a lot of the participants in the battles of the last couple of years would have to walk onto the fire and be burnt themselves if they were to actually move on from that experience.
Yeah, and I always think it's interesting too that if Tony Abbott has a spiritual father, it's not Robert Menzies, it's B.A. Santa Maria. And look at what B.A. Santa Maria did to the Labor Party. It would be deeply ironic if in the end we saw a split of conservatives that basically coalesced around Tony Abbott after the next election that split the Liberal Party, because then he would be fulfilling the deed that was signed by his spiritual father.
And one of the interesting things when you talk to Liberals about, well, who does the party represent? What's happened with the leadership in recent years is that you get this observation that some people feel Tony Abbott was never really a true Liberal. He is more like DLP. A Democrat, a DLP, B.A. Santa Maria type of person. And some Liberals really, really see that in him, his social conservatism, his interventionist policies, like his famous paid parental leave scheme, a tax on big business to pay for a welfare scheme that funded parental leave for women at home. On the other hand, the same people will point out that they don't regard Malcolm Turnbull as a true Liberal in many ways, as not a hardcore believer in Liberal philosophy. But these are the leaders that they've had. That to me sums up their difficulty in deciding what they fight for.
We're just going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a few moments.
Hi, I'm Jess Irvine. Thanks for listening to Please Explain. The Sydney Morning Herald and Age newsrooms are home to the country's most experienced economics editors and reporters, delivering trusted news and analysis. But we can't do it without you. Our subscribers get unlimited access to our award-winning independent journalism, plus exclusive behind-the-scenes stories you can't get anywhere else. Subscribe today and support news you can trust.
Speaker, equal representation of men and women in this Parliament is an urgent imperative which will create a culture change. There's the blinkered rejection of quotas and support of the merit myth, but this is more than a numbers game.
So speaking of structural issues, I want to talk about the Liberal Party's woman problem, or as I like to think of it, its man problem, because I don't think that the women are actually the problem here. There's no way that they're going to be able to address this before the next election, because the pre-selections are already in place, or if they're not in place, they're being cemented by emergency powers. How are they supposed to go to the electorate in May next year and say, we are representative of you, when they could end up with as few as 5 women in Parliament if it goes the way the polls are saying?
Yeah, they can't plausibly do it. All they can do is change the subject and talk about their strong suit and scaremonger, as I was saying earlier. That's their best shot at getting power. The motif of this last leadership spill, the obvious one that's in the headlines this week is an angry Malcolm Turnbull back in the old vengeance cycle. It was Tony Abbott, now it's Turnbull's turn again. We saw the same thing from Labor. But I think the bigger motif that the public will take from that spill is exactly the question you raise. What's the problem that the Liberal Party has with women? Think about this. What if it were a man who'd been the deputy Liberal Party leader for 11 years? What if that man had been the Foreign Minister of Australia for 5 years? What if that man had had a flawless time as minister, flawless performance, and that man was way ahead of everyone else in the party in the public opinion polls as preferred leader? It's unthinkable that man would not have been made leader. Instead, because it happened to be Julie Bishop, she was cast aside in the first round of the ballot. And the party, part of the party's problem, I think, is that it didn't even recognise that this would be seen as a sexist problem. Then, following that, all the bullying stories that have emerged. Put it all together, plus the fact that the Liberals have currently got only a quarter of their MPs are women, versus Labor, which has almost half. So it's double the proportion of the Liberals. it makes it look like a party that really does have a big problem with sexism. Let's label it. It's sexism.
Yeah, and they've got a huge problem with women voters. So what was clear out of Victoria as well is that women between the ages of 18 and 50 now really don't like the Liberal Party and are voting against them. So,
which is exactly what Kelly O'Dwyer told that leadership group, isn't it?
Yeah, both sides of politics noted it before the election that that was what their research was telling them. And you think of the pitch that the Labor Party had in Victoria, which is going to be very similar to what the federal election will look like. It was about a whole bunch of services on education, on health, and at the other end on aged care. And women disproportionately have to deal with those things. Kids in schools, people who are getting sick, aged parents, they're the things that women have to deal with. And this government and the one in Victoria, and on the face of it, when you don't see reflected in the ranks any women, there are now three women, I think, in the lower house in Victoria. There are more Davids in the Liberal Party's ranks than there are women in Victoria. It is absolutely absurd. And to give lie to the argument that's constantly made about, oh, we need to do this on merit. Craig Kelly just got saved by the Prime Minister for the second time, a second Prime Minister. He was going to be bounced out of the Liberal Party, out of his seat of Hughes, by the membership. Oh, let's call them the base, because that has to actually be the base. And they can't do that for some women. They can't find this. There is no merit in Craig Kelly's selection. So I'm sure there must be some Liberal women out there. And as I said to a couple of the coalition people, how do you people breed when there are no women in your ranks?
I do want to go back to the Craig Kelly thing, but David, how is the Liberal Party supposed to get women to sign up to even be thrown on this bonfire?
What they need to do is remember what they've done in the past, because one of the most incredible things about their current problem with appealing to female voters and actually recruiting women for good, winnable seats is that they've done it before. And John Howard did it in 1996. There was a big influx of women when Howard arrived as Prime Minister in 1996. Some of those women were the most important backbench MPs to back him as leader throughout his tenure and keep him in power. He depended in large part on some of those women winning marginal seats and then cementing them. And that was the result of some work in the 90s by Liberal women, to mentor and encourage female candidates. Now, I can remember talking to Liberals over the last 10 years about some of those ideas and about whether they could be done again. And yet the party wrestled with executing on that strategy. And that was a huge failure. And now they're paying for it.
And isn't it telling that you have the revolt of the women in what were once safe seats, the seat of Indi, Cathy McGowan, Karen Phelps in Wentworth, Rebecca Sharkey in Mayo, and we've seen around Cathy McGowan now in Victoria, she's starting to get women who are pressing hard for those Liberal seats in Victoria. And could there be anything that demonstrates to you more that these women are absolutely electable when they can do it without the party's support? So, you know, there's an absolute electoral imperative for the coalition to fix this.
So voters want them to fix it. Half the population of Australia wants them to fix it. And plenty of people in the Liberal Party want to fix it. What's going on? Is there...
A review is going
just,
on.
Right. But is the problem just because there's been a lack of leadership on this?
Yes. Lack of leadership. But you would have to look at several leaders for that. I mean, this has been several years in the making. And so the lack of leadership was clearly under Tony Abbott, because he had one woman in federal cabinet, and that said to everybody that he was not taking that issue seriously enough. So how could you have some kind of mentoring or recruitment strategy when the Prime Minister had decided that he only needed one woman in federal cabinet? But then did Malcolm Turnbull do enough? Well, there's no sign of a solid enough recruitment strategy when he was Prime Minister either. So it's been a failure that's been several years in the making.
Okay. And as you said, Peter, they're just going to have to keep changing the subject. Craig Kelly, David, can you explain what happened there?
Craig Kelly, the Liberal MP for Hughes, which is southern, a little bit of southwestern Sydney as well, It's a solid Liberal seat. They desperately need to keep it, but he has lost control of the branch, the Liberal branches in his own electorate. He was heading for certain loss of pre-selection because he has a rival in that area called Kent Johns, who's got more support among the Liberal branch members in that local area. If anybody was going to listen to the base, they would have allowed an open vote by the members there on the pre-selection, and Craig Kelly would have been moved on. Instead, because he's got allies in the Conservative wing of the Liberal Party, they made an awful lot of noise, and Scott Morrison decided that the best way to keep the peace was to appease that group and to keep Craig Kelly pre-selected and to basically endorse everybody who's a current member. So there are other members in New South Wales who were also endorsed, but only Craig Kelly was under threat in this way. Now, it's a huge contradiction because the Conservatives have been championing for years the idea of more democracy in the party, more plebiscites, more rights for local branch members to have a say in who their MP is. Here they get one of their own who's under threat, and suddenly all that gets thrown out the window and you get an intervention by Scott Morrison. I think an unwise intervention, because he used his leadership authority to save this individual, blew up an argument within the party. Now the moderates are at each other's throats over who backed Craig Kelly, because we had the moderate wing that came in and supported him. So it's left a lot of unhappy branch members and MPs, and I think was something where Scott Morrison didn't need to do it. I think in the future, given that Craig Kelly was a vote for Peter Dutton in August, after the election, Scott Morrison should not want Craig Kelly to be in the Liberal Party room.
So did he do it out of a fear of Craig Kelly going to the crossbench and therefore him losing yet another vote in Parliament, or over the fact that he is on Sky News every 5 seconds and he's just a loud voice and he just couldn't handle the distraction?
A bit of both, but technically they say there was no threat from Craig Kelly to go to the crossbench. The implication from all his commentary has been pretty clear that he was willing to go to the crossbench, and that was a huge danger for Scott Morrison.
Yeah. Peter, how is the leadership of the Liberal Party supposed to explain to voters the state of democracy itself within the party and who gets to make decisions and who what powers people who actually join the party have?
This is a government that it's like a bunch of desperate people in a rapidly sinking life raft. The Prime Minister's sticking fingers in holes as they appear. There's no thought. I mean, this is a desperate survival mission going on where, you know, one finger gets stuck in one hole and another hole emerges and starts leaking, and he's got to try and stick a finger in that. And you saw that in the Craig Kelly manoeuvre. You saw that in the Julia Banks manoeuvre when it looked like she said she was going to go to the crossbench. Suddenly she finds the Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, in her office, offering her what Josh Frydenberg called a Bob Katter package, where they gave Katter almost a quarter, or they promised Katter almost a quarter of $1 billion in infrastructure spending for his electorate to try and keep him on supply and confidence support.
So that's another benchmark
in the House.
The Katter package.
The Katter package is another benchmark of political desperation. Julia Banks joked afterwards that she should have asked for a dam for her seat, which is in Melbourne, and she would have got it. Get anything you want in those circumstances. This is a frantic rescue mission. Those larger questions, the party's going to have to figure those out after it manages to get through to an election.
Okay. And earlier this week, in a late night meeting, the Liberal Party did bring in rules to make it harder to dump a sitting Prime Minister who had won an election. Was it a wise move, Chris?
Well, they've finally worked out that people hate it. I mean, you would have thought that they would have worked that out after having watched the Labor Party do it. And look at the trajectory. Labor Party loses one leader, goes to the next election, forms a minority government, loses another leader, gets pushed out with a forked stick against a coalition leader in Tony Abbott, who was not widely liked by the electorate. The Liberal Party has just done the same thing. And what do they imagine will happen at the next election? And they keep telling us, as the coalition as the Labor Party relentlessly told me about Tony Abbott, oh, they won't vote for him. People don't like Tony Abbott. Guess what? They did, because they were telling that the government that they wanted it to leave. And we'll see exactly the same thing at the next election. I cannot see how whatever they do between now and May 11 of next year is going to do anything to save them. What they have to try and avoid is an absolutely epic defeat. And I think that's the circumstance they find themselves in now. It is, what can they save out of this? And what does happen to this party when it goes into opposition?
I thought that rule change, Tory, was, which is really now mimicking Labor, what Rudd did in his final weeks as Prime Minister, is both parties finally, after going through this decade of this sort of vengeance cycle and madness and self-indulgence and frenzy of regicide, it's an acknowledgement of public disgust. An acknowledgement that they need to do something to fix the situation. In that sense, it's sort of a token gesture to the electorate. Okay, we understand you didn't like it, and we're going to try and make an effort not to do it anymore. But look at the larger backdrop. This week, the Museum of Australian Democracy presented some research which showed that Australian trust or confidence in democracy had fallen in the last decade, in the last 11 years, fallen from over 80% to 40%, so it's halved. Other research has about a third of the electorate saying they would prefer a strong leader who doesn't have to go to elections. So you've got a third of one of the world's most successful and prosperous democracies and one of the freest countries saying they're open to the idea of dictatorship.
Now, dictatorship or at least fixed four or five-year terms.
No, they're talking about a strong leader who doesn't have to bother with elections at all. We're talking about an electorate that is now open to the idea of authoritarianism.
When you said this on the first episode of Please Explain, I thought you were mad.
No, this is exactly right. This is a measure of the failure of the political system. And the two main parties are actually really lucky. They're living on borrowed time. They're really lucky that no minor party has come up with the magic formula and just taken power from them. I mean, each new minor party comes up and the public experiments with it and then it implodes and the public moves to the next one. Each of them has gone through that cycle. And the public is just, the two main parties are just lucky that there isn't a surging new populist party or a surging new popular party to come through the middle and wipe them out, because the public is deeply sick of both parties.
Mm. So an April 2 budget, which will presumably kick off an election campaign for a May election. Can the Labor Party hold it together and keep their heads down long enough to get through this?
The Labor Party?
Yeah.
Oh.
Are they just going to be very, very quiet from this point forward?
They've already taken big risks, I think, and been, I think brave in some ways would be the right word, because on negative gearing, for instance,
yes,
we've seen Labor in the past go there and then retreat. Here they've held the line and they're taking a negative gearing tax change to the next election after taking it to the election in 2016. So they're already out there with some big policies. The change to dividend imputation, it's so technical, but it raises so much money. It raises $5.5 billion a year, $50 billion plus over the decade ahead. It's an incredibly big source of revenue with a lot of losers, and yet they're holding the line on that. So they're not a small target, but the government has made it. The government is in such a mess in many ways that Labor can afford to go out there with big policy ideas.
I think the Labor Party has worked out that you cannot be a progressive party and be a small target. So this is a good thing. So they are the one, we're talking about their agenda most of the time, and the government is talking about frustrating their agenda most of the time. That's the public debate. So the Labor Party has won on that ground. They are at the moment incredibly united, and they'll be more united by the fact that they think they're going to be in government soon. They are a really well-qualified team because they've been in government before. And I think the fear, if I was in the coalition now, is that the last iteration of the Labor Party, if you want to look back at history, was the Whitlam government. It goes in, it tries to do everything in the space of a very short period of time. It can't keep its concentration. It hasn't mastered the art of governance. And because of that, it fails. This time round, I think you'll see them organise themselves in such a way where they must understand the mistakes of the past. And that was a mistake of governance, that they had good ideas. They failed in execution, and they failed because of divisions. the big fear I'd have if I was in the coalition is that they actually get their act together in government, and that you see two or three terms of Labor government. And they certainly have the agenda to do it. The problem that they're going to face will be one of overreach again. There's a lot on that agenda. Governments usually can only manage two or three big things in a term. They should try and limit themselves to that and return to proper cabinet government. By that I mean an end to the era of the political commentator who's actually a political player. So you say, I'm the Minister for Infrastructure. I'll come and do an interview with you on infrastructure. If you want to talk to me about the politics of the day, I'm going to pass. And get your backbenchers off the airwaves and focused on parliamentary committees and doing their jobs.
Do you think they can do that, Peter?
Ooh, that'll be tough. The invitations to, you know, get their faces on the box it's a narcotic.
We all just want to be on television, don't we?
Well, I don't know.
Let's crack the backbench.
I've got a good face for newspapers, Tory. I'm happy to stay off the telly, but it's a narcotic and they're going to find it very hard to pass it up, especially, you know, in the first flush of victory, discipline will probably be fine. But as the years go on and ambitions flare, it gets harder to police.
It also gets harder when, if and when you have a substantial election victory, you get a lot of new backbenchers who may not have been vetted all that carefully, and you can get some relatively outspoken ones. So it's going to be an interesting crowd. But I think the other point about where Labor's at the moment is there's so much focus on the government's problems, the spills, the division. Sometimes there's not enough credit given to Bill Shorten and the Labor team in their daily practice of politics. They're incredibly disciplined. They're incredibly sharp. They're also, when they need to be, incredibly aggressive.
They perform very well in the House of Reps, don't they?
Yes, but it's not just in the chamber. It's everything that they do. It's the way they research their opponents and point out their flaws when they need to.
They're also incredibly lucky, may I say, with the government tearing itself apart day in and day out. Labor doesn't have to do much to look sensible and mature and poised.
But if they can bring the same, if they can bring the same sharp political instincts to government, then I think that will be an interesting contrast with, say, the time when Malcolm Turnbull was Prime Minister, because I think there were many times where he did not have the political cunning of somebody like John Howard to just get through difficult situations, and I think it will be very interesting to see. We've seen displays of political cunning from Bill Shorten, and that's what he would need if he is to become Prime Minister.
And look, they constantly underestimate Bill Shorten at their peril, I think. You know, and they think that if they say that he's a union boss, that that's going to frighten people anymore. I think that the stuff, the boogeymen of the past, that do not frighten the children of the present. So they had a whole Royal Commission on Bill Shorten, and they really barely laid a glove on him. He is a much better political operator than they think. No, he's got some clunkiness in public, but if he wins the next election, the people of Australia will give him, and people do, will give him an opportunity to be Prime Minister. If he can unite his team, stay in government, look vaguely sensible and coherent, then look at the contrast to the past. He'll look like a winner.
The bar has fallen that low.
Yes, it has. I think the only truly safe prediction is that next year will not be boring. So thank you very much for joining us on Please Explain.
Pleasure, Tory.
Thank you, Tory.
Thanks to our guests this episode, David Crowe, Peter Harcher and Chris Yorman. If you know someone who should be listening to Please Explain, let them know about us. If they're not a podcast listener yet, grab their phone and get them subscribed for weekly episodes. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. Subscribing to our news service gets you unlimited access to award-winning independent journalism and great behind-the-scenes content you can't get anywhere else. Follow the link in our show bio to get a subscription today. This episode was produced and edited by David Escort and Nicole Priestell. Technical assistance from David McMillan. And Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. I'm Tory Maguire. Thanks for listening.